today we're here with Harold Eyer, who is one of the best-known comedians in Norway. He's, I guess, the maybe the Jerry Seinfeld of Norway or something similar. Harold made a very interesting TV show called Brainwash, and that's what we're here to talk about today. So, Harold, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's an honor.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about who you are and what you've been doing?
Yeah, I'm a trained sociologist, but after working a couple of years in research, I went into television and comedy, but I kept on reading science. And then my focus shifted from traditional sociology to biology and evolutionary psychology and behavioral genetics and, you know, Steven Pinker, David Buss, all that new science of human mind and human nature. That was, for me, that was so new and interesting and went against everything I was taught at university. So after doing some research, and I felt that the whole academic life and our whole culture, they was uninformed about these perspectives. So I decided to make a popular science show about that.
I think I read a quote from you somewhere where you said you felt cheated.
Yeah.
Because that's how I felt when I learned about all this stuff too. It felt... Yeah, I mean, can you maybe talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. Because basically, when you study social science, especially sociology, there's an implicit premise of human beings born with a blank slate, that basically all our feelings and the way we think and our whole culture is just a product of socialization and influence from our parents, media, society. But the other part of the story, the nature part, it's being presented in a very... It's not ignored, basically. For instance, why is it so that children who have parents who are academics also become academics? Why this is called the reproduction of the class society? Why is this reproduced from one generation to another? And the only explanation I was given at university was that it has something to do with how you're socialized at home, how you're influenced by all the books in the shelves your parents tell you to read. And if somebody asked about what about genetics, it would be, maybe you would be laughed at or ignored, or you would say something, or the teachers would say something like, yeah, I think we gave that way of thinking up after the Second World War.
Right.
So, when I started reading these things, behavioral genetics, so when you study twins and children who are adopted, it turned out that genetics has a whole lot to say. It means even more for us today than it did 100 years ago, which sounds strange, but if you imagine a very talented girl 100 years ago, she couldn't use her talents, she couldn't take an education, but today... At least in rich societies, everybody can take an education, and that implies that genetics has it's more important with genetics today than 100 years ago. And I find this very interesting. And I wasn't told anything. Nobody told me this at university. Even I studied class structure and inequality a lot. I was very interested in that. And because I wasn't told about this perspectives, I felt I was I think it was like an intellectual scandal.
Right.
So,
you know, we're taught about Darwinism, Charles Darwin, and we're taught that we're descended from the sea and we came from fishes and that's it. And we're not really taught really what's going on. And I saw an interview with Richard Dawkins talking about it, and he talked about how he looked at it the first time and that's how he understood it. And then 10 or so years later, he looked at it again and then he really started to understand it. And it wasn't until the third time that he really looked at Darwinism that he really got it. And I found that it was the same process for me too. And it's shocking that we're not taught all of this.
It's true, yeah. It's and we present with kind of a parody of it, because sometimes you read in the newspapers, you know, scientists have shown that they found the gene for watching television, or men have a bigger penis because of that. And the explanations are so simple. So you learn to ignore them. And most intellectuals and smart people tend to ignore those perspectives because they find it too stupid and too simple. Mm. So they never take the effort to really go into those problems or those perspectives. When I did that, I realized that, for instance, when it comes to Darwinism, most liberal, educated people believe in Darwin, but they believe it stops at the neck.
Right.
You know, or psychological life, or inner mental life has nothing to do with evolution. But of course it does. It's the most expensive organ when it comes to, calories. So, of course, evolution has formed the way we think, the way the neurons are wired. So that was a big, great insight for me as well, to learn myself to always think in those terms. How can evolution have formed this way of thinking, this feeling?
Right, and we always look at it like in terms of international development, that we just need to send aid to all of these poor countries. And when I started to get the perspective that, okay, that they're actually, it's not just their culture that's different, they're actually genetically different, that then leads to different approaches of how to help. Just one simple example that I've noticed over the years, when I was in Haiti after the earthquake, I was talking with some of my friends there, and they were saying, look, Adrian, this is, you know, we appreciate the outside help from the Western world, but they're doing things that are killing our industry. And one example is bed nets are something that we could make here in Haiti, but instead they're being donated, which just kills our local industry. Yeah. And so, I mean... there's that sort of stuff where when you can say, okay, so maybe Haitian people are a little bit different. Bed nets are something that they can manufacture and doesn't need to be manufactured and shipped out from Germany, that they can make locally, and that could be a local industry that could generate pride for the people doing things themselves. That starts to become something important and relevant. And I feel like not understanding this stuff has actually probably hurt a lot of third world countries that are trying to develop.
That's interesting. Yeah, absolutely.
Another interesting example, as I've been reading through this stuff, is here in the US, there was they brought pygmies over from Africa, and pygmies are a race that are known for having an IQ of an average around 54. And they ended up the ones that were here were kept in a zoo, and it doesn't sound like they were treated all that well. So that's at the extreme end. And then we've had Hitler that's come along and created the Holocaust and done a lot of bad stuff. There's obviously some really harsh elements to all of this, which I would actually be in favor of brainwash and saying, hey, let's not talk about all that stuff because some of it is too nasty. I mean, where do you stand on those sorts of things, and how do you think it should be handled?
Well, I think that's difficult. In Norway, we don't speak about races at all. We don't use that word because it's so closely associated with the Nazi regime.
Right.
So we don't even speak about that. We all speak about skin color. We don't talk about the whole race thing. And I realized, so in the beginning, as a starting point, it was taboo already for me and for us. And then I talked to some behavioral genetics that study, adopted children, twins, all that, and I just asked them, can we talk about race? And they said, no, we can't talk about that. Okay, why not? Turn off the camera. But why can't we talk about it? Is it because you have some results you don't want to talk about? Yes. So then we realized, oh, this is a this is a hot button, huh? This is really, really dangerous. So we realized that there are nobody knows whether, for instance, there's a genetic component to the intelligence differences between people, because nobody really wants to study it. And those few who say that, let's just face reality, there are some genetic differences when it comes to average intelligence level between different people on this planet, they are far right. They are they are extremists, and they want to talk about it. So the whole field of thinking about some inherited differences between people when it comes to mental faculties, the whole field is so it's so political already. So that's just the beginning of it. And then and why should we do it? Why should we focus on it? Could we learn something from it? Would it benefit some people? I'm not sure. Charles Murray, he said that we have to face these realities now, because if we want to help people, it's better to know why. Some do it better in school, why some score a lower scores on IQ tests. But at the same time, people are so stigmatized. Imagine yourself being, for instance, if Charles Murray said that on average, African American have a lower IQ score, and that's because of the genetics. And if you were a man, a smart African American man, it would hurt you. Of course, it wouldn't help you anything. In an ideal world, people would treat everybody as individuals, but in the real world, we don't do that. So I'm not sure. I had this process where I was really interested in finding out, but after a while, it almost made me sick, because after a while, I didn't really want to find out, and I'm not sure. I saw how these right-wing extremists just love the topic. You know, they love talking about it. Let's face the realities there, so it kind of tainted the whole field for me. So I'm not sure if we can, if there's any use in that kind of science, actually. But it was interesting to going from, you know, I was a bit innocent, like most people in the Western world, at least in Europe, realizing, hey, there may be something there. Africa may never come to our level of wealth because they haven't got, you know, the genetic resources. Some said that in a sub-Sahara country, there are so few people with an IQ over 120, and you need a lot of those people, you know, to run modern society. There are too few of those, so they will never get to the same level of wealth. And I kind of, maybe it's right, I don't know, but it scared me.
And that's also the thing, like if you think then you end up putting a mental cap on how far things can progress, and so in a lot of ways it's better to have that brainwash so that you don't have that mental cap. I just want to add in something, because we are talking about right-wing material, and I know there's a lot of right-wing sites on the net. I spent a decade living in Santo Domingo, which is the Dominican Republic. It's a country that is 90% black. Anyone is listening or watching this extremely right-wing, please understand that I don't support your views. I support science, and I don't support extremist views, and certainly not racism.
Yeah.
you made this series, which you've put online, and we never heard about it anywhere. I found it online. Someone mentioned it online in an interview with Steven Pinker that you'd made this series, and I started watching it, and I was like, oh, my God, this guy figured out how to take really sensitive material about both gender and about race and communicate it to the world, and you did it in one of the most feminist countries in the world. So do you want to talk about what you did and how and the response?
My original idea was just to present some new and exciting findings and some new and exciting perspectives. But my background is from comedy, so I know something about how to tell an exciting story. So I realized I wanted to make the show as a detective story, where I started with kind of a murder. For instance, why is it so that women in this gender egalitarian society still prefer not to work with engineering and mechanics and so on, but prefer to work as nurses? That's a mystery. That's a murder. So, and there are two suspects here. There could be nature, it could be nurture, it could be both. But then I realized it would be fun if there were two opposing teams there. One said it can only be nurture. That's a traditional sociology perspective. And the other team said it can probably be some nurture, but it's a lot of nature as well. So then the whole program become more exciting because there's suddenly two teams against each other. So, and that was just a way of, you know, presenting this, because that motivated me. I want to go out and find out if this is true. Norwegian researchers be wrong? And when we went back to the Norwegian researchers and presented them with Steven Pinker, for instance, what he said, and they, as most people do, scientists as well, just, no, I won't change my mind at all. You know, confirmation bias or disinformation bias, as it's called. And I said, okay, this works. This is a good television program. But when we broadcasted it, it exploded. There was people, the debate in national newspapers and in television programs went on for at least half a year because we attacked some of the most rhetorically strong people in our society. They were furious. It had such a tremendous effect. It really took us by surprise that people would get so mad. But on average, I think there was a feeling that many intellectuals were not seeking the truth, but were too influenced by ideology. And it shouldn't be, or scientists shouldn't care about having one pet theory because it suits one left-wing ideology better. So I think it was a relief for a lot of people as well. At last, somebody dares to go against this political correctness that's holding the debate down and stigmatizing some perspectives as right wing, and you know, so it was, people felt it was kind of liberating. So all in all, it was I don't know how much it changed, but it kind of the some of the left wing intellectuals now aren't as arrogant and ignorant as they used to be, and that's a good thing.
So the fallout from your, because your TV show is what, 7 episodes or something, that went on for 6 months.
No, the debate afterwards, you know.
Right, the debate. I mean, that was the fallout. Like everything that happened afterwards went on for 6 months.
Yeah, absolutely, and I was it was so much. I'm used to reading about myself in the paper, but that was like 4 or 5 papers every day.
I went and read, because there's nothing about you in English, and I went onto the web and was reading through Google Translate some of the Norwegian newspapers, and I mean there was a lot.
and still, no, it's having its own life on web. So these days, a lot of people from Germany has contacted me.
Oh.
And and those who are interested in this question. Especially the gender shows, the shows about the gender, and because there are some Christian conservatives in Germany that worried about this gender egalitarian project that's going on there. So there are all that's interesting with science. It's always some group, some political group that is trying to use science for some goal.
Yeah, that's really one of the that's one of the things that shocked me, because I've always felt like, you know, we have the noble scientists who are doing their noble research, and, you know, we can trust everything they say, and to see that a whole lot of it is either not being shown or being used for political purposes is uncomfortable. And that's why I thought what you did was amazing, because you took a very difficult message and you presented it. In terms of political correctness and things like that, has that changed much in Norway?
Partly, because I think some intellectuals on the left has realized that, you know, 50 years ago, it was the left who believed in biology and who was oriented towards science, or at least before the Second World War. If you go back even further, the left, they were the rationalists, you know. They wanted to do research, they were seeking the truth, but the right, they were conservatives, and they religion and spiritual life, they were not really interested in science. But that, so there's a pro tradition on the left to be, you know, seeking the truth and be on the side of science. So I think they kind of found back to that, to the roots. We should be the ones that work against all dogmas. We should boldly seek the truth. So it's easier now to say, hey, how can we, why is it, how do genetics influence children's different abilities to read? How can our class structure today has more to do with genetics than before? But we don't want the class structures. How can we kind of make those differences between people smaller?
Right.
I think this is easier to talk about those things now than it was pre-brainwash.
Did you feel any threat? Were people like, did you get any threats against you?
No, but one man on the other side, one of the gender researchers, though, he got some threats from angry white men, I guess. So because they were, you know, this a lot of angry men out there, of course, they are really angry on women and the whole gender egalitarian project. So it was more scary for him than for me.
That's unfortunate too.
It is. So we had a good dialogue going. We discussed a lot. My opponents and me, I contacted them and say we have to cooperate here, because this can get out of hand. You know, so many feelings. We are touching so many hot buttons here. So we should, and we had a good dialogue. So we kind of tried to be civilized and not letting, you know, not calling each other names. But I was. In the beginning, a lot of my older sociology colleagues said that, hey, you have a midlife crisis, and it's because of your divorce, and it's a typical male white thing to be interested in genetics, all that stuff. But we kind of took that down, so.
Yeah, I saw some of that stuff, and I wasn't going to bring that up, but yeah.
Okay. As a comedian, I'm so used to so much, you know, noise, and I don't really care. So on the Big Five scale, if you know that personality scale, I'm very low on neuroticism. So,
all right. So, were you doing in the right place then? So having researched all of this, and then obviously in gender differences, what do you think about concepts like free will?
That's interesting. Free will. It's meaningful to talk about free will. And it's a huge and very complicated question, but we're not free. We're probably not free to choose our preferences. They are kind of given. But we can choose between. We can choose what to do still. I mean, we can go against some of our natural feelings. We can do, we can, we have the pill, so we don't, we can have sex without having children. We can, there's a lot of room for maneuvering in this field of emotions and mechanism we're born with. So I think the more we know about how we're, how our mind works, the freer we get. Because you can relate, you know, you can think, I have a tendency to think in short term. I know I'm a, all humans are bad long planners. Now I can know about this. Mm. So then I can make, we don't have to be slaves of our emotions and preferences anymore. We can choose to, we can, if we know how our mind works.
Right.
And why it works as it does, we can maneuver, we can, you know, take, we can organize our life in a way that makes us freer. It's a bit philosophical question, all this, but I feel that the more you know about yourself, the freer you can get.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that surprised me. I've never had any interest at all in philosophy, but researching this stuff has had me looking at Aristotle in particular, but some Plato as well, because it does all tie back. Those are the guys that thought a lot about all these things.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Have you ever heard of an author named Ayn Rand?
Yeah.
Have you ever read any of her books?
No, I haven't. No, I should do, because I see that there's a lot of... liberals and or libertarians and conservatives, they always name her as their favorite author, but I haven't.
So she's one of my favorite authors, and I've been looking at her stuff a lot more recently. And one of the things that is interesting that you may find interesting, firstly, a lot of people might know Ayn Rand is like one of the most hated authors in the world because she makes people... one friend said that she makes people toxic, which I think there's truth to that. But what she does do is give people self-confidence as well, which I think is important. There's a really interesting thing that's in Atlas Shrugged, which is her key book, and I've never heard anyone talk about this, and you may find this an interesting connection. In Atlas Shrugged, there is the State Science Institute, which is supposed to verify... how science works in the country and its connection with business. And there's a lot of problems with corruption in the State Science Institute and how their message is being distorted and so on. I think you may want to read Atlas Shrugged, and it's also been turned into a movie because the parallels between that and what you've found is identical, and I think you'll find that really interesting.
Okay. Yeah, really. I think... I should read it, absolutely. It's on my list, as you say. But I think that one of the... It's always a problem. For instance, those, at least in Scandinavia, who do gender research, they tend to be the same kind of people. They vote, they're all on the left. You know, it's never healthy to have a group of people seeking the truth who are all the same. It's good to have both genders. It's good to have people from different political stance. So I wouldn't say that the social science in Norway was corrupted, but it was it only looked at the world from one perspective, and they did that because they were all thinking the same way. They had the same background. They had the same values. And so we have to make sure that we should quote not only women into social science, but conservatives and people who believe in the free market. So it's healthy to have these different opinions struggling together. It's easier to seek the truth and to be intellectual and corrupt if there's a polyphony. Do you say that, of voices? You know, different perspectives and
pluralism. I think this is what you're saying goes to the heart of nature versus nurture. We don't know where the line is between nature and nurture, and it's somewhere there, and you need to get both perspectives to be able to find where the right position is as we work things out.
Absolutely.
And also, I certainly wouldn't say the impression I got from your TV series that it didn't come across that the people weren't, maybe corrupt isn't the right word, but they weren't seeking the truth as much as they should.
And they had decided already what was the truth, and they didn't take the other perspective seriously. That was the biggest problem for me. They had this, you know, they hadn't been reading. Their level of knowledge when it came to biology was like an eighth grade, so it was nothing really. I think they're, if you want to help women, if you want to make a society where the genders are equal, have equal rights, I think it's good to know whether it's whereas there's a natural difference in women and men's psychology. I think it's smart to have that perspective to make a happier life for women, instead of pretending that the genders are equal and then pressing women and men to do things they don't want to.
Right. Exactly. You went to, do you want to talk more about some of the gender things that came up? So you managed, so the biggest people that responded after your TV show, was that the angry white men in Norway?
Yeah, they were angry at these gender researchers, yes, very angry. They had a lot of, you know, years of feeling, I don't know why really, but they had so much bitterness and hate against these left-wing gender researchers, yes. Mm.
And so, like, what happened? Were they just complaining in newspapers and stuff? I mean, what was sort of some of the things that went on?
There were mostly these, the kind of trolls on the internet, you know, sending, commenting things on the newspapers' websites, and maybe sending mails anonymously. And I always told them that... I've been doing quite a bit of provocative comedy myself. I wouldn't compare myself to Jerry Seinfeld, but more like a more tasteless Jerry Seinfeld maybe. So I'm having my share of angry mail. I've never been attacked or anything. So I just say, hey, these are like dogs. I said to these researchers, in the mail you get, then these men who send you these angry mails, they are like dogs who bark but never bite. Mm. And they didn't bite. But suddenly after, you know, what happened in our country last summer, where we had this terrorist attack, this right-wing guy who killed, you know, 80 people. Have you heard about that?
Oh, obviously, yes, absolutely.
Suddenly, I said they didn't bite, but that guy, he did bite.
Did he ever mention anything about your program?
No, he didn't. But there are men like that out there. He obviously don't go as far as Breivik did, but still. So afterwards, I was kind of, okay, they didn't bite, and I'm happy they didn't. So because there's a lot of aggression out there from, you know, a lot of women experience that when they are in a television program or when they're debating, they get really hateful mails, you know. Really nasty, vulgar males. So there is a lot of hate there against political correctness. But I think, I hope shows like Brainwash will give people, the angry white men, a feeling that it's okay to discuss these things, instead of the political correctness tends to hold this debate down.
Right.
We won't go into this problem. For instance, like 10 years ago in Norway, it was forbidden to discuss any problems when it comes to immigration. Hmm. And in Sweden, it's still like that. And what happens is you get a right-wing party that's really popular, really far right-wing, but you lose control over the debate because the debate is not free. But so it's important always to try to have this free discussion in society instead of saying we can't discuss this, because that makes people really angry.
Right. Well, now, I mean, the internet's taking off and taking the lid off a lot of these topics anyway, so we are finding all these things out. But, I mean, yeah, you certainly took it to a level that no one else ever has. How was the response of women to the show?
You know, most women, some women, I've heard from they were born that they, hey, you're a woman, you can't do this. I'm sorry, women aren't as, you know, whatever as men. So in one way, they are tired of hearing that there are some differences between men and women from birth. But the other, on the other side, they've been pushing so from you know, the state and the education system have always been pushing women, hey, go into science, go into engineering, you should do more of this, less of that. What women's interests in, you know, fashion, humans, feelings, all that, it's not as valuable as men's interest in, you know, science, technology, money, status. So many women felt it was liberating, you know, I'm so happy somebody says this, because I have been thinking this all my life. But I want to work with people. I'm not interested in earning so much money. I just have an okay job, work, and have an okay life. So from some women, it was, or many women that I talked to, it was, they felt it as like a burden was off their shoulders. Because as a man, you know, I feel I can do anything. But as a woman, there are so much expectations. Don't do too much of that. You don't dress like that. You should be more interested in that and less interested in that. But I think they should follow whatever they are, what their preferences are.
Right.
So most women were happy, and of course some women who had background from, you know, had based all their worldview on this kind of research, they were kind of provoked. But we tried to, our message was not you were wrong, but our message was we have to think on both nature and nurture, basically.
Right.
So it was it wasn't very extremist.
And we don't know where the line is between nature and nurture and all these things, and we probably won't for another 100 or more years. I mean, we can't know, and it's probably going to depend per person too. So it's
absolutely, and it will strangely enough depend on what society you live in. I mean, two non-identical twins, they ended up having basically the same life 100 years ago. Today, two non-identical twins have a very different life because what they're born with matters more, and the social background matters less.
Hmm.
The same thing for women. Women can, you know, if you were a smart woman 200 years ago, what could you do? Nothing. But today, you can realize your potential. So nature has more to say now than it used to, in a way.
Women were able to make progress in the past, but it was harder. I mean, we have people like Marie Curie and others like her that have done amazing stuff. I mean, I mentioned Ayn Rand. She's a woman. I like to think of Ayn Rand as the woman who taught me how to be a man. You know, she gave me a lot more self-confidence.
Exceptional women. Like, they had exceptional traits to be able to break through that, all those prejudice and all those gender roles.
Right. There's no doubt, obviously, that that's all improved. It's just, where is that line in the end, and making sure that people are living, instead of just distorted lives, happy lives. And that, I think that goes for everybody. And I think that would be your goal with all of this, would it not?
Absolutely, yeah.
So how far did the message spread? It was obviously, it caused a furor in Norway. Did the message spread across to Denmark or Sweden or other countries?
No, we're planning to make a similar show in Sweden because, you know, it's to watch a show in a foreign language with subtitles, you have to be more than average interested in the subject, I guess. So we have discussed if we want to try to make some kind of remake in Germany and Sweden. But we'll see. There's so many other things to do. And I'm a bit, you know, I want to go further on new things. I don't want to, that's what I did in 2010. I'm that kind of a person.
Yeah.
Impatient.
I saw that you went to you visited the house of Richard Lynn, which I thought was fascinating. He had a big house.
Absolutely. I don't know about his health, or he just came down and then disappeared, and it was strange. I think his and there was some I don't know, but it was it was strange being there. He was and I'm not very sure about he calls himself the last. What do you say, eugenic?
Right.
He's the last one who wants to. So and in this whole race thing, it's impossible to tell how weak is his research actually. It's so politicized. This it's impossible to know. You know, these samples he's got from all these different parts of the world. I don't know, but I think he's probably right about the East Asians, that they are on average having a higher IQ. I guess so. I think he's right, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the sort of research I think should be done, but then done in a way that's not judgmental. It bothers me that research would be being repressed. I think we should know all this stuff. But I thought the way that you handled it in the show is exactly right. You went and talked to the guy, and I think you presented it in the way that was appropriate.
Mm-hmm. But he's a let there be no doubt about it. He's a racist, you know.
Oh, he is racist, is he?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, interesting. How did you get that feeling from him?
I can see the contempt they had. You know, there's two different. I kind of felt there was two different kinds of people who were interested in these intelligent differences between people, races, and one. Some people are interested because they want to help, you know, they want to do good things. The other the other camp, they want to have a society where some are repressed and some are supposed to have more children than others. So there's this kind of a love camp and this hate camp. It's obviously with him that he has contempt for Africans, basically. He doesn't like them.
Yeah, well, that's not okay.
You can see this snare on his face when I talk about it. He was disgusted. That's why I laughed, because I saw this was beyond. I never met a guy like that. But he was polite and nice. And, yeah. Hmm. But yeah, he was talking off camera. He was saying things that, you know, about. He was trying to flatter us with us being the whitest people in the world, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? Wow, okay.
You know, the Nordic race, they are just the best.
Okay.
My uncles and they fought against Nazism and, you know, this, so it was too much, so we couldn't. But I started to laugh because it was so bizarre.
I mean, I don't even feel like we have to defend that, like, because there's nothing to say. It's just dumb. The inspiration for doing the show, you started. You said somewhere that you were going to do just one show, and then you read The Blank Slate by Steven Pinker, and you decided to go a little bit deeper. Like, where did all that come from? Was most of your content from there?
Yeah, we kind of based the whole series on The Blank Slate. We took different topics, you know. Gender, sexuality, class differences, race, all the hot buttons in the Black Slate. So it's a, in a way, it's our adaptation of Black Slate, I would say.
Right.
So Steven Pinker has done most of thinking. But the way we organized it, I think Steven Pinker is pretty good, and he defends the other part in the beginning of the chapters. He builds this building before he tears it down. It's very efficient, and when you want to communicate, instead of when you see like a movie where there's a message about that says war is wrong. You see that in every scene. War is bad. War is wrong. War is. People are killed, but it's much more you're much more convinced about the anti-war message if the first half of the movie defends the idea of going to war, you know?
Mm.
And then war is necessary, and war builds character, war is good, and then you show the audience that, hey, war is awful, war is gruesome, war, it doesn't solve any problems. It makes much more impression.
Right.
So that way of Pinker does that as well, and we took it to another level by even really making it into a detective story where you really believe the traditional sociologist's perspective in the beginning. They're so right.
Has Pinker watched your show?
I only talked to him once after that, and there was a lot of people there, and he just said, I'm so happy that it was such a success. We sent the links to him, but I'm not really sure. I hope so. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, no, I mean, me too. He's talking about some of the things that need to be talked about, and he's one of the very few that's doing it.
And he has some of these people who he's so tender, and you know, he seems so interested in it. He's not a fanatic,
right?
So he's a very good communicator.
Yeah, he is.
Oh yeah, it's a pleasure to listen to him. So yeah, I'm used to meeting people, you know, from who are famous, but that's the only one I met. I think that I was really starstruck when I met Steven Pinker.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was the guy, right? So,
yeah.
Although interviewing David Boos, how was that? What was he like in Texas?
Oh, he was great, and he thought it was great fun to see the clips. I wish so much we could have more of him. But when he saw these clips on Norwegian Scientist, you could see his face turned red. It's exactly those kind of people who've been criticized him for stupid reasons for years. So he's so tired and angry. He's like, why can't people start to realize that biology, evolution, has formed our sexuality and our mind?
Right.
I mean, it's like he's been fighting this war for, I don't know, 50 years. And it was so... So he has thought about all these basic problems about the other perspective, you know, the sociology perspective. So it was very interesting to talk to him. And when we came there to his institute in Austin, I've never seen so many female students before.
Hmm.
There were so many from all over the world who was his research assistant. So it seemed like he had created this dream institute where he could... and that was good to see, because some people think that his way of thinking is a male perspective, but obviously there were a lot of women who thought his way of thinking was interesting.
One of the comments I noticed in the press was talking about your style of journalism, and I was interested to see it. I mean, because for anyone listening to this, you need to go and watch the whole series. But a lot of it was around, okay, here's the view in Norway, and then I'm going off to the exotic researcher in the other country, and then getting his point of view. And so I'm watching this here in New York City, and I'm like, man, but he's like, they're saying the same stuff over here as well, maybe just not as bad. What was some of the feedback over there about that, and how did that go down?
The feedback in Norway or the feedback in the States?
Sorry. Yeah, just in both.
Yeah. I think I told the Norwegian researchers, I'm gonna show this to other people, to other scientists, and I said, sure, yeah. But they didn't know that I was going to Cambridge and Harvard.
Right.
So they were a bit surprised. that I was going to the top level. And the English and American researchers, scientists, they thought it was great fun. Because, you know, they felt free. They could talk, they could say whatever they wanted to. Because if some of the British scientists, they said that if they had some comment on BBC that was slightly controversial, or edited together in a way that made it controversial, they would spend so much time defending themselves. But here, a guy coming from a small, tiny country interviewing you, you can talk, you can say whatever you want to. So I think they thought it was fun just to, they felt free.
Right, yeah.
Constrained, yeah.
I mean, it was really well done. I thought you did everything exactly right.
In all justice, I was accused of, you know, manipulating. That I didn't tell first. I didn't tell really what I was trying to do. I was kind of agreed in that critique. So they said, hey, this is about science, and you treat us like we're criminals.
Well, I think it's just because it worked. I don't.
Yeah. So the Norwegian Journalist Ethical Committee looked into it, and they said it was okay. A bit rude, but okay.
you got an ethics investigation after the show?
Yeah. That's it. Sure. Yeah. But you can't be. It doesn't have any consequence if you're if they evaluate your project as being unethical, it doesn't have any consequence. I don't have to pay any fee or anything. Just about, you know, honor and losing face. But I was happy. I was, I was a bit nervous, I must say.
When you won an award for like freedom of speech or something, right?
Yeah. Mm, that was nice too. And that was, a lot of social scientists contacted me and said, I have thought about this for years, but I didn't have the guts. And in a way, it was easier for me because I'm not into the academic system. You know, I work in television. Hmm. So I answered these mails that gave me support. Why don't you write a piece in the paper and defend me? You're a professor. You're a well-known, respected intellectual. No, I won't do that. It's too much hassle. So when I got that prize, I felt it wasn't like more known official recognition from the intellectual establishment, which I appreciate.
It's that sort of censorship that goes on. It's really unfortunate. I mean. Yeah. If we're going to have a really free society, we should be able to go through all this stuff. We're almost out of time. Is there anything that you want to tell us about which we haven't covered?
No. I would recommend Jonathan Haidt, who has written a book called The Righteous Mind. Which I really think that take the whole brainwash discussion, nature versus nature, nurture, one step further. He's studying how different, how these tendencies we're born in can be weakened, or they can make them, culture can make it stronger. Mm. So I find his work very interesting. So I hope to do something maybe based on his work. So it's exciting times we're living in.
It is. I'll have to read that book. I haven't heard of it. Mm.
Okay.
Awesome. Well, Harold, thank you very much for doing the interview.
Thank you, Adrian. I'm looking forward to read it and to watch it.
Thank you again.